Good afternoon. So last time we talked a bit about device drivers. We mentioned that device drivers had these two pieces. We had the piece which handled the request from the user and the piece which handled a request from the device. And typically the structure of a device driver was the part that handled the request from the user, which we called the top half. Checks a buffer, and if something's not in the buffer, it sets things up, so hopefully that will happen in the future, and waits, and that buffer will get filled or drained, depending on whether it's a read or a write type of operation, by the bottom half, which is called by an interrupt from the device driver, and handles when the device is ready to either give you data or process data. And we talked about the interface that the OS actually used to talk to the hardware, and the simplest model we had is the devices were connected to the memory bus, and they implemented the same interface our memory did, except now reading or writing memory locations would do magical things of actually making the device act in a way we wanted it to. And we mentioned that if we're having our devices on the memory bus anyway, we can do this kind of optimization, where the simplest thing is that if the device has data, the OS reads it using that memory interface and puts it where it wants. But the device could also read data from memory instead of reading it, having the OS write it, and could write data to memory instead of having the OS read it from the device. And this is called direct memory access, and it's important for performance when we have large data transfers, where, yes, you have to do a little extra work to set up this because you have to give the device a pointer and so on, but it's going to be faster because the OS can do other things while the data is being moved into memory, and hopefully the OS can arrange for the data to be moved to or from memory that it would want to move it to or from anyways, if we didn't have direct memory access, if we had to access the buffer manually on the device controller. So then we looked into file systems, and we talked about, well, what do file systems do? And they're about, we have a hard drive, which is organized in these groups of sectors, and we need to figure out how to make it contain files. We need to say, what part of the hard drive contains each file? How do I get a file name and actually figure out where on the hard drive it is? And we started looking through a simple solution to these problems in the FAT file system, FAT standing for file allocation table. We saw that to handle the problem of where is the data for a file, we had a linked list stored in that file allocation table where we have for each cluster, the next cluster that contained data for a file, were clusters where the unit in which this file system organized the disk. Each cluster, we learned, could be one or more sectors, and they just chose how that size statically somehow. And we also needed to find files by name, and we started saying, well, we need directories then. We need a list of files with names and where they're located, and our representation for that was that we'd have a file where rather than containing data that you might read, it would contain this list exactly. So questions before we go back to what those directory entries look like, which was where we stopped last time. Anything? Okay, so we had these directory entries. And the idea in these directory entries, this is what FAT chose. So they wanted to make it so it's easy to read off disk. So they decided every directory entry is a fixed size. And most importantly, we have to store the name of the file, which is at the beginning, which they store as 8-character file name and a 3-character extension because they were not very forward-looking as to what we might want in file names. and you need to store where the file is located, which they store as a cluster number, so an index into the disk for the first part of the file, and then you use that file allocation table to find out if there's more than that. They have some attributes, so most notably, is this a directory that we're looking at? So this information is stored along with the file name. And probably most importantly that I don't have a highlight for explicitly, we have a file size. Because if we remember, the file allocation table told us, we had this linked list of clusters, it told us when that the end of that was, but it didn't tell us how much of the last cluster we used, so that information is in the directory entry in this case, because typically a file will not be an exact multiple of the cluster size. And when an application's reading from it, the operating system wants to say, oh, you're at the end of the file, not just say there's some extra data here. Okay. And FAT has this convention that, well, we need to indicate when the end of a directory is, because often we'll allocate a whole cluster for directory entries and we won't use all of them. So we need to have represent empty space. So they have this convention that file names starting with a null character don't mean a real file. They mean that's the last thing in the directory and there's nothing more. And they also have a representation of this E5 value, which they use to represent a whole. And the idea there is that when you delete a file, well, one thing we have to do, that we're going to have to talk about in a bit, is you have to deallocate where the data is. So we have to talk about, well, what does it mean to deallocate it? But another thing you have to do is you have to free up the directory entry. One option for that would be we could just rewrite all the directory entries, like to shift everything over. But in a big directory, that's very annoying to do. And FAT wanted to just modify things in place, so they have a way of marking this directory entry is no longer used, where the idea is they just modify that one directory entry, well, the whole sector around it, but they don't need to like shift anything around in the directory to delete a file. You still could if you wanted to save space, but that's the simpler option. That's why they allow that. So any questions about anything in this directory entry here? Yeah?
The next directory entry.
So the question, the next directory entry. So the directory entries are stored as just an array. So immediately after this directory entry in the cluster is the next one until we run out of space in the cluster. Okay, good question. Other questions? So we have this directory entry, and you have an assignment coming up where you're going to need to actually manipulate these. So one thing is, how do you do this in C? And one thing you could do in C or C++ is you could look at this picture. You could say, I'm going to get a char star pointer. I'm going to add, to see if something is directory, I'm going to say, OK, I got the beginning of the directory entry at 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 to it, dereference that, and then I look up what those attributes mean. And if I want to get the cluster number, I do 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and then I get a byte there and a byte there and keep going and get the low bytes. That's something you could absolutely do, but there's a common thing that I would recommend doing and that real OSs do, which is that we look at this structure on disk and we very carefully write a C++ struct that has the exact same layout as it. So here is that directory entry as a C struct. Now we've done something special here. We have this thing labeled pat. So this is not actually part of the C standard, but it's an extension that both GCC and Clang support. And usually there's some equivalent for any other compiler. And it says, hey, don't do any padding on this. So normally, compilers will add padding mostly to not cross between cache lines or page boundaries in the middle of like an integer. Adding this attribute pack says, no, I don't want that. I want things exactly right, one after the other, with no space in between. And that's a good thing to do, because that means it's going to be the same on disk, even if like we change platforms. Another thing we need to do is we need to make sure, well, when I switch from a 32 to a 64-bit system, that the struct doesn't change in the size of the things inside it, which is why I used a bunch of typedefs here for fixed-sized integers. Yes?
Does that not support files more than 4 gigabytes?
Question is, does FAT not support files that more than 4 gigabytes? So, not this version of FAT. And I guess under things it doesn't support, another notable thing it doesn't support is we have this thing labeled a short name. So FAT supports long names. They are not part of the upcoming assignment. It supports long names by using extra directory entries, which you can tell are not normal directory entries because they have an attribute value that's set to something special. And you, for the assignment, can just ignore those directory entries, pretend they don't exist. Or not pretend they don't exist, just skip over them. You can't pretend they don't exist because they're kind of in the disk images we give you. But you don't need to do anything with them. So by using these fixed size entries, the memory layout of the struct is exactly the same as it's going to be on disk. And that means we can just copy byte by byte from disk into one of these structs in memory. Or more likely, we can have a buffer containing data from disk and cast it to this struct and just use it as a struct and not have to worry about counting the bytes or cells. We just do that when we carefully write this struct. You might wonder also, why are the names like this? So this is the struct I give you in the skeleton code for the assignment. These are the names that Microsoft chose in their documentation. I'm just being consistent with them. I'm not saying that you should follow this naming convention. Questions about this? Yes.
For the assignment, since it's not padded, is that going to pose any problems that we need to worry about?
Question is, since it's not padded, is that going to pose any problems you need to worry about? No, you just need to make sure you use a non-padded version so the compiler doesn't do something under you. And because you're telling the compiler that it's not padded, it will do anything special it needs to do to deal with accessing things. So in x86, it turns out that you don't need to do anything special to access things which aren't aligned properly. There are some other architectures where that is not true. Okay, so I told you about finding files in a directory, but we actually like have paths that contain multiple directories. We're used to specifying some directory slash another directory slash another directory slash some file. And the way we're going to deal with this as an operating system with that is we're going to like take foo, the first part of this path, and read the root directory to find that directory. Then we're going to, once we find foo, read foo's directory entries to find bar. Then once we find bar, we're going to need bar's directory entries to find baz, and so on. So this is how we go from these directories to actually looking up a path. But we have a little bit of a problem here, which is that we need a root directory. So we need to figure out where is the root directory. We can't look up in a directory to find it because it's the first one. So we need some way to know where that is. And FAT uses probably the most common system for giving this information, which is that there's a well-known location on disk which has what's called a header. And this contains general information about the file system. It contains all sorts of information, not just where the root directory is, but about the configuration of the file system. So for example, it says, oh, this file system expects 512 byte sectors, and uses 4 sectors per cluster. And if we decided on a different value when we initialized this disk, we would have a different value in the header. Yes?
Is this necessarily at the very start of the disk in the first sector?
So the question is this necessarily at the very start of the disk? So fat chooses it to put it in the first sector. It doesn't actually put it at the very start of the disk. That's why I have this thing labeled OS startup data. So it's a little after, but at a fixed location. And where exactly you put it is a choice you make when you make your file system. And the reason they don't put it at the very start is because there's other things which want to be at the very start related to loading operating systems that they didn't want to compete with. So that also has this field known as reserve sectors. And this is to say how much space is there at the beginning of the disk before the file allocation table. Because one thing, we need to decide where is the file allocation table. It's near the beginning of the disk, but we need to know exactly where. And when we set up a disk, we make that choice, and we write down how much space there is before it in sectors. And after that, that's where the file allocation table is going to be stored. They also need to specify, or end up specifying, how big is the file allocation table. So they have its size listed in sectors. That's another one of the entries for this header. And they have the root directory cluster. So one of the fields in the header says, where is the root directory? It gives the first cluster number. If the root directory is more than one cluster, you look at the file allocation table to figure out the other clusters, just like you would for a normal file. Yes?
Is there a reason why 10 was chosen?
Is there a reason why 10 was chosen? That's just my example. Because it's in the header, whatever software sets up the disk can choose to put it wherever it wants. So there's one other field that I have in my excerpt from the header, which is kind of interesting, which is this number of file allocation tables. So FAT has a backup of the file allocation table that's sometimes stored after the original file allocation table, where the idea is that, well, if we have some damage to the disk, it would be really, really annoying if that damage occurs right here. So to kind of hopefully maybe mitigate that, they have a second copy of the file allocation table at a different location. And this is actually a relatively common feature of file systems to have this sort of very important data have a second copy to make it so that you can't just lose one little piece of the disk and not be able to figure anything out about what's on the disk. Okay. Question? Yeah?
So for example, like let's say you scratch the disk, like if it were a physical disk.
Yes.
So in terms of like scratching a disk, like something physical, would that like hurt like adjacent portions of memory?
Question is, in terms of scratching a disk, would that hurt adjacent portions of memory? Probably, we will have probably a more specific answer to that in a bit. So this is the header. And the header, like our directory entry, you can represent as a struct. And that's typically what you do. So we have our sizes, our reserve sector count I showed you earlier, the information about backup copies of the file allocation table, and so on. Okay, so I've talked a bunch about things you need to do to read from the FAT and allocating directory entries for a file. But something we need to do that we didn't talk about is we need to allocate space for a file. So we need to figure out, I have a new file I want to write, where do I put it? So how do we choose where we store a file? In order to do that, we need to figure out what parts of the disk are available for the file. And in the FAT file system, this is done with the file allocation table. that they have chosen that cluster number 0, which, because we have these reserved sectors at the beginning of the disk, and because that's where the file allocation table would be if we didn't have them, that's never a valid cluster number, so they use it to indicate this space is free. So the idea is that if you want to allocate space for a new file, you scan through the file allocation table to find some free clusters. Once you find them, you choose some of them however you want. You don't have to choose the first ones if you don't want to. And link them up and allocate a file. And then we have, after you do that, then you can write your new directory entry. So simplest thing to do would be you look at the directory and you have an unused entry, one of those things where the beginning of the directory entry marks that, hey, it's new data. Sometimes you'll be unlucky and all the directory entries in that cluster will be full, in which case you would allocate a new cluster using the same method. You look for a free cluster, add it to the directory, make a new cluster for the directory, which is all unused entries plus the one you actually wanted. Yeah?
So the directory isn't like a static value, like these amount of sectors.
Question, so the size of the directory is not fixed? Yeah. So because we can keep adding clusters onto it, we don't have any limit to how many files a directory can contain. Yes? So we just chose some free clusters, and you can do whatever you want. So maybe the more sensible thing would be to point this. So here I'm saying that it's 21 to, 21 goes to 22, 22 goes to 24, and 24 is the end of the file. So it's a three cluster file that I'm allocating space for, and those clusters are 21, 22, and 24. I need to have a next pointer for each of them. So the first next pointer was 22, the second was 24. Does that make sense? Yes, in this case, in this example. So, other questions? Yeah.
Would there be strategies to put files that are in the same directory closer to each other so when you pull out data, they can sort of pull out multiple sites?
So the question is, could we try to put files that are in the same directory close together? Absolutely. Does the FAT structure help us with this? Not really. Yes? Question is, the backup FAT updated real time? That is the intention. Yeah? How would you know you need to use the backup? So as we'll talk about when we discuss disks, hard drives typically won't give you bogus data. Instead, they'll say, sorry, I don't have that data anymore. And so that's, so you know, because the hard drive would give you an error. Okay. Other questions? So, as I said, so we allocate space. So we make a pointer to the first cluster. So our first cluster was 21. So that's in our new directory entry, which either replaces an unused one in a cluster we already allocated for the directory that contains the file, or we have to make a new cluster to store directory entries, and it goes in there. So another operation we might need to do is deleting files. So now that we know how free space is marked in the file allocation table, we know how we delete files. We set all their file allocation tables to 0 for free, and we overwrite the directory entry with one of the unused ones. Okay, so questions about this? So let's do a little exercise. So say I have a fat file system, and I have 4-byte fat entries, 32-byte directory entries, and 2,048-byte clusters. So let's say I have a directory with 230-kilobyte files. How many fat entries do I have, and how many clusters outside of the fat do I need to allocate to store that? You can check with your neighbor to see if you got the same calculation.
So each one takes 15,
right?
200 of them, which is 600. Wait, 6,000.
15 times 200. Isn't that?
It's the same thing as 100 times 30.
Okay. Someone want to go through a partial answer? Okay, so how did you get three clusters of directory entries?
We have 200 files, and each of them uses a 32-byte directory entry, and so that's about 6,000 bytes of entries, and we can only store 2,000 in a cluster.
Bytes. Okay, and this is about three clusters. So this is three clusters. We need to round up, it turns out. And if we're doing it exact, this is 6,400 bytes. And three clusters is going to be enough more than that. That shouldn't be a problem. I want to double check this to not. And so it turns out we need four clusters, because this is a case where 2,048 times 3 is going to be 6,144 bytes. So we need four clusters to store the directory entries. So this is four clusters for the directory entries, plus we need to store the files. Now each of the files is 30K, which divided by 2K clusters, we need 15 entries per file. So this is plus 15 times 200 clusters for the files, for data. And each cluster needs a fat entry filled in. So questions? That, yes.
Could you just like reread what you wrote, like before cluster?
For clusters of directory entries, okay. I can probably. Of directory entries. Clusters of data plus 15 times 200 clusters of data. Yeah.
4 byte fat entries doesn't matter. That doesn't help you solve this.
So we ask for clusters outside of the fat. So no, it doesn't. If we ask you how many much space the fat entries for these clusters took up, yes, it would. Yes.
Where did 15 come from?
15 because 30 kilobyte files divided by 30 kilobyte divided by 2048 bytes per cluster gives us 15 clusters for that much for each file. So then we have this second version, which is, what if we have a directory of 2,000 3-kilobyte files? So here, we need space for 2,000 times 32 bytes, which is going to be 64,000 bytes, which I'll just use my calculator to, which means that bytes... Which means that we need 32 clusters to store that. That's rounding up. And we round up because we know that we're going to have one cluster where we're not using all the space. There's going to be unused entries in it. We can't go the other way. And each of the 3-kilobyte file takes up 2 clusters, one of which is only half used. Because we can only allocate a whole cluster to a file, even though we're only using half of it. So we'll end up with, so data is, so 32 clusters for the directory entries. And the data is going to be 2 times 2,000 equals 4,000 clusters of data. Questions? So 4,032 clusters in total. Yeah.
No, it does like the... I'm guessing the OS tries to optimize this sort of math problem to make sure you use at least amount of clusters possible.
So the question is, when we're designing our file system, do we want to like choose the cluster size to like make this better? And the answer is probably. That is a trade-off that we have to make. And it's something we'll talk about a bit later when we talk about file systems that are probably better than fat, which is not hard to do. Because FAT's main advantage is that it's really simple. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have FAT. So we're going to talk about like things that FAT is bad and good at. But to think about like what makes a file system bad or good, we want to think about one thing is wasted space. So we can kind of see that with FAT, that we have cases where we're not using space that we could use, maybe. But a big thing we're concerned about is performance. And one thing with FAT that seems a little suspect is that we have this table at the beginning of the disk that holds all the data for everyone on the disk. And you might say, is that slow because it's bad locality? But to know whether that's actually bad, we need to talk about how to these disks actually work. So we're going to talk about how hard drives work. Now, you might say, wait a moment, no one uses hard drives anymore. We're all in the SSD world. The biggest reason I'm going to talk about hard drives is because they're what file systems are designed for. Like, you would think, hey, we should design file systems for solid-state disks. That's a great idea. And maybe there's been some researchers who've tried, but these are not the file systems that exist in most consumer OSs yet. They maybe should be, but that's not where we are. Also, hard drives are still probably the best storage mechanism if you want your storage to be always accessible and to have a lot of it. They're probably the most cost-effective way of doing that. If you want a lot of storage and you don't care about it being always accessible, it's possible tape is still cheaper. Seriously. Because big tape libraries, which hold like many petabytes, are a thing. And have like robots to move the tapes. Also, solid-state drives sort of started by trying to imitate hard drives. So their interface is the same one that hard drives provide, even though the internal workings and the performance is very different. Because they were designed to be kind of drop-in replacements for hard drives. So let's look at a hard drive. This is the inside of a hard drive, picture from Wikipedia, because I'm not adventurous enough to carefully open up an old hard drive that I probably don't have lying around. So we have some components in here. We have an arm. So this is an arm which has what are called heads on it, and these heads are what actually read and write data. And this arm physically moves over these platters. While these platters spin, usually pretty fast, something between like 5,000 revolutions in a minute and like 15,000, depending on your hard drive. And the idea is that data is stored on these platters and read by the arm by passing over it. And because this is how things work physically, if you want to read data, you need to actually have the arm move to where the data is, and have that part of the disk spin and pass over the heads to actually read or write that data. So there's some terminology that exists to talk about this. So one thing we're going to talk about are cylinders. So a cylinder is a slice of the hard drive that the heads can read without moving. And if data's all in the same cylinder, it's going to be faster to read that data together. So one consequence of this is that if you're an operating system, you would like to put data that you're reading together on the same cylinder. If you're a hard drive designer, remember we talked about reading sector numbers? You're going to number the sectors such that things in the same cylinder have similar numbers, to help the operating system do that. Historically, the operating system actually told the disk, hey, I want to go to cylinder X, track Y, sector Z. This is not a modern interface. Now they're just one number, but that number is designed such that numbers close together are going to be in the same cylinder, numbers even closer together are going to be in the same part of that cylinder. The idea. So we have this cylinder, we have the components of the cylinder which are called tracks, and on those tracks there are the actual sectors that we read and write. And when we're thinking about the performance of the hard drive, there are several things we need to be concerned about as far as how much time it takes. So one thing is that we need to get the heads to the right cylinder. And this is known as seek time. And this takes a significant amount of time compared to other things we typically do in an operating system. So when you have to move pretty far, it's 5 to 10 milliseconds, depending on the disk. If you have to move the heads only a little bit, it's a lot faster. There's also rotational latency, which is that we have the heads in the right cylinder, but we have to wait for the right sector to come around. So that depends on how fast the disk is rotating. So some more expensive and less suitable for computers who don't want to be really, really loud disks will rotate faster and have a lower time for this, and other ones will rotate slower and have a higher time for this. But typically that's between 2 and 8 milliseconds. Basically assuming we have to go wait for the disk to spin around to get to the data we want. And once the heads are reading from the right place, then we have to actually send the data, and this is a lot faster. So typical disks are 50 to 100 or maybe like 150 megabytes per second once we start reading from the right part of the disk. But the biggest cost here is this 5 to 10 milliseconds plus 2 to 8 milliseconds to actually get the head there. And if we're only reading a little bit of data, this is actually really bad. Like, transferring one sector, like 512 bytes, at 100 megabytes a second, if you're waiting, you know, 15 milliseconds between each sector you're transferring, well, that's not even close to 100 megabytes a second. So, one consequence of this is that as an operating system and a file system designer, we want to keep data that we're reading close on the disk physically. So we want to keep it close together. Close, you know, same sector, same close sectors. And we want to try to read more than one sector at a time. Because if we're reading one sector, the cost of reading one sector at that location in 100 is very similar because we have to wait this amount of time to just start reading or writing. So we have this idea that we want to do adjacent accesses, and also we want to read and mark multiple things at once. So those are the most important components of disk latency, but there's also some other things we might need to worry about. So another thing is that we can request multiple reads at once, or multiple reads and writes at once, in which case they're going to wait in line. And typically, this is something which actually the hard disk does. So the hard disk typically has a disk controller, and that disk controller actually will handle multiple reads and writes at once, and it will choose an order for them, rather than having the device driver for the disk actually decide what happens in what order. So there'll be some time waiting for that to happen, and then the time to physically manipulate the disk to actually do the reads and writes. And I guess another notable thing is that cylinders closer to the edge of the disk might be faster. Maybe. Because they spin more. Because the heads go over more data quickly. So, as I said, historically, the OS had a lot more control of what hard drives did. Historically, the hard drive said, this is this cylinder number, this head, this track is what you're reading and writing from. This is not what's done anymore. These days, hard drive makers didn't want to expose that information, so they just give you a sector number. But low sector numbers are out the fast part of the disk, or I guess this is, yeah. Low sector numbers, you know, station and disk, but the mapping is decided by the disk controller. I'm not actually sure if this is correct. But the key thing is that adjacent sector numbers are adjacent on the disk. So the operating system, even though it doesn't know exactly where the data is on the disk, because the disk controller gets to make that decision, it gets to choose adjacent sector numbers, and it knows that those are close together, so reading them, writing them together is going to be fast. Yes?
Does that mean that cylinders overlap with each other? If the, like, each sector number, because, like, if they're discrete cylinders, then...
So the question is, does that mean cylinders overlap with each other? No. They're still separate cylinders. It's just that, you know, two consecutive sector numbers might be at cylinders that are next to each other. Okay. So the seek time between them is still very low. So the interface the OS gets to the disk is that it gives reads and write requests with sector numbers and the location to put the data because it's direct memory access, either location to write the data or read the data, write the data, you know, get the data to write from, sorry, and to read the data into. And typically, there's a queue of pending requests. And the most common strategy is that you give it a queue, and you can specify an order. So you can say, write X before Y. But if you don't do that, the disk controller will decide what's best, which is actually good. So that's about the disk interface. And that tells us that one thing when designing file systems you want to do is you want to try to read multiple blocks of data together. And we want to try to keep related data together. We don't want to look at lots of different places on the disk, because that's going to be really slow. Even if we're reading relatively little data, we're just doing all this seeking, and that's going to spend most of our time. So another notable thing about hard drives is that they're unreliable. So for example, I guess one question I've asked, so who here has had a disk fail? So it's common. And there's some studies. So Google and their data center in the early mid-2000s, used cheap disks that were used a lot. And they discovered, depending on the type of disk and exactly where it was, a 1.7 to 8.6 annualized failure rate, meaning that if you took a disk, the percent chance it would fail over a year was between that, in that range, so which is actually really high. Now, these are for cheap disks, which are used probably a lot more than the disk on your desktop. But that's really high. Now, these are disks which fail in the sense that they need to be replaced. But it turns out that disks fail in some ways where they don't need to be replaced. And in the study, they found out that 9% of their disks which didn't fail, which still worked, have what are called reallocated sectors. So what happens is modern disk controllers, because they don't have this static mapping to sectors, there's a reason for that. And one of the reasons is that sometimes parts of the disk stop working. And rather than making you throw out the disk when that happens, the modern disk controller just chooses a different part of the disk for you. So it keeps track of what parts of the disk have stopped working. And when it stops working, they just allocate a different part of the disk. They set aside a little bit of the disk at manufacture time to do this and use that instead of the original location. And this is the expected behavior on these disks, that they expect to have to do a bunch of this. And that's just normal. And you might say, how do they tell it's bad? So one thing disks do under the hood is they use error detecting codes, basically like storing a hash of the data, in order to know when the disk is no longer storing the correct thing. This also means that when you try to read from a disk and it doesn't work, it's not going to give you bad data most of the time. It's usually going to be able to say, nope, I didn't get the data I expected, because it has these error detecting codes everywhere on the disk. Which it needs to implement this functionality anyways. And also needs, because it turns out that you need to do this even to get the disk to kind of work even for the sectors which aren't bad. You need to have redundancy. Some questions on this? Yeah.
How does the head actually, what's the mechanism that allows it to actually read the disk?
Question is, what's the mechanism that allows it to actually read the disk? So this is a place where my physics is poor, but it is looking for a magnetic signal that is very, very small. The head is also very, very small, like physically very, very, very small. Other questions? OK, so I mentioned that we had this queue of requests. And this happens in the disk controller. Also, the operating system might have a queue. And one thing we want to do when we have this queue of requests is we need to decide, well, what order do we do them in? And we want to take advantage of the fact that if we do adjacent reads and writes together, that's fast. So this problem is known as disk scheduling. In this case, we're not scheduling like processes. We're scheduling what read or write do we do next on the disk. And like with process scheduling, we have some conflicting goals. So one goal we have is we want to minimize seek time. We don't want to waste time moving our head back and forth. And you might say, OK, so let's just do that. And if we did that, you'd probably be unhappy. So let's talk about how do you minimize seek time. Well, you just choose whatever makes the disk head move the minimum distance. So on this picture, I'm showing you sort of, let's say that this is the inside versus the outside. So the disk, this is sort of the disk flattened out. So this whole thing is spinning in a circle, and we just kind of flattened out that circle to make it clear that the head is moving back and forth between the in and outside of the circle. And if we're doing shorter seek time first, we have our request, which I've marked in blue, and we just go to whatever request is closest right now. And we just direct the head to go there. Sometimes a request might come in while we're doing that. That's too bad. And we just do that. And this minimizes our seek time as best we can do sort of eagerly. And you can see here we're making our first decision is that, oh, I have two places I can go. I'm choosing to go up here because that's short. So I'm going to spend less time seeking by doing that. Yes?
Does it also take into consideration like the size of the amount of data that actually needs to be written?
So the question is, does this take into consideration how much data actually needs to be read or written? This policy does not, because we only care about seek time. But you could imagine that maybe that would be a good thing to think about. And this simple policy, even if the sizes are all the same, has a big fairness problem. And we can see that down here, that we have some request where we just went up to the top of the disk near the inside and never had a reason to go to the outside. So these requests just sat here for a very long time. And there's sort of no limit on how long they could sit there. They can get starved. So there are other policies we can use that avoid that. So one of these is called scan. The scan policy is you just go towards the inside, then towards the outside, then towards the inside. This still does a pretty good job at lowering seek time, because like we're at least not skipping over anything. And we'll tend to have like requests pile up, so we'll have a bunch of things to do when we get to the inside or outside of the disk. It has a little bit of a disadvantage in fairness. It's not nearly as bad as that shortest seek time, but we kind of favor things which are in the middle of the disk here, because at any run of time, we'll get to them sooner. So there's another model, which is circular scan, which doesn't do that, where we just go outside to inside, outside to inside. And this seems like this is probably a lot worse. But one thing that's notable is that you might physically have a mechanism that lets you reset the disk to the outside. That might be something you can do faster, because you have hardware which like just moves that head very quickly to a well-known location. Yeah.
Would you say circular scan is like you go from like the inside to the outside and then reset back to like the inside and start again?
Or back to the outside.
Or back to the outside, so like
yes.
Outside in, and then just kind of pick up the arm.
Yeah, so you pick up the arm, move it back to the outside. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
When you say inside and outside, is that referring to like the center and edge of the disk, or like literally the
inside? Inside, by inside I mean here, by outside I mean here. Okay. So that's circular scan. So we have a bunch of these algorithms. So we have this take the shortest seek time. It has the problem with starvation, but it's like, in a sense, the most efficient use of the disk. There's even a variant of it where we take into account rotational latency, called shortest positioning time first. Then we have that scan algorithm where we move up and down the disk. This is sometimes called elevator because it's basically how an elevator decides which floors to go to. It moves up and then down. You would probably be unhappy if your elevators decided that if you were on the fourth floor and the elevator was going up and you wanted to go to the seventh floor, it would say, oh, there's people on the third floor, let's go back down. So that's the elevator algorithm, and C-scan, which is just the one directional variant of that. So this is something that either the OS or the controller can do, because both of them can have multiple disk requests where they need to decide if it's the OS, what order do I send these to the controller in? If it's the controller, I got a bunch of requests from the OS, when do I do them? So that's about disk scheduling briefly. So, and there's more like with scheduling that we'll just kind of skip over. I just went through the simple ones to give you an idea that this is another scheduling problem with sort of very different ideas than our processor scheduling problem, even though we have the same kinds of problems. We have this sort of fairness versus efficiency issue. So another thing disks do, which is notable, is that the controller often has a cache. So it often has DRAM, sometimes a rather substantial amount, sometimes like hundreds of megabytes of DRAM. And it caches stuff that's on the disk. So when it gets that queue of requests, it can just hold things it thinks the OS might read. And it can also hold data that's waiting to be written. So if it's holding things the OS reads, that can like make things faster. This is also a way where when it has to move a sector to a new location, it can kind of hide the extra seek time that would create by just reading it into the cache in advance at some other time. Another thing they can do is they can hold data that is waiting to be written. So writes go a lot faster if you just write to DRAM and then write to the disk later. You might complain, wait a moment. Doesn't the DRAM go away if I lose power? And the answer is yes. So that's kind of a problem for reliability. So operating systems which really care about the second part need to generally use special commands to tell the controller, no, really, write that data to disk now. And there are commands to do that. So if we're thinking about how these hard drives work and what file systems can do, so one thing we want to do is we want to do either contiguous reads or writes or lots of nearby reads or writes, because that's going to lower our seek time. We're going to get more data at once. And another thing we can do is we can take advantage of the fact that we can efficiently do this like list of reads and writes, because it's going to choose how to use the disk effectively, and we can start lots of things at once rather than doing what might be your natural implementation of FAT and like saying, okay, I need to read the first cluster of the file. Let's read that. Now let's read the file allocation table to find the next cluster. What would be better is to get all the clusters in the file and request them all at once. Because the disk will affect, because the disk can effectively just scan over the disk to read all that sort of in one pass. Whereas if you have to make the request one at a time, then it has to like reposition the head or wait for the disk to rotate in between them. Okay, so questions about our how our hard drives work? Okay. So I told you how hard drives work, and we're also going to talk about how SSDs work. And as I said, SSDs are going to imitate hard drives, but they're going to use a very different technology. They're going to use flash. So they're going to use flash memory. And their architecture is that they're going to have these flash chips, which are, the name is solid state disk. They're solid state, they don't have moving parts, which means that flash tends to be a lot more reliable. And we have this controller, and typically this controller holds like a full-fledged CPU. By full-fledged CPU, I mean like often it's like the same class of processor you'd get in a cheap mobile phone. And some RAM. So flash We have no moving parts, and you can read this in sector-like sizes of called pages. So there's this unit of flash called pages, which are like 4 16K that you can read. You can write data once to the flash between erasures. So you can write a bunch of data when, you know, freeform, and then you can erase a whole bunch of data, but you can only erase in large blocks, larger than a page of the flash, often 256 kilobytes or megabytes. That's the only way you can erase it. So you erase a bunch of data, and then you can overwrite it once it's erased. But, and once you write it once, you can't do it. The way this usually works physically is that the flash, like, when you erase it, it becomes all ones, and you can flip those ones to zeros, but not the other way around. Or it becomes all zeros, depending on your point of view. And flash also has this limitation that you can only erase and rewrite blocks around tens of thousands of times. After that, it starts failing. So flash implements the hard disk interface, SSDs implement the hard disk interface on top of this flash memory. So they need to implement a whole bunch of things that don't quite map RevCraft. So one thing is that we need to be able to write a sector at a time. And we can't really do that in the physical flash because we need to erase these large blocks in order to overwrite them. And those blocks are much larger than our sectors are going to be. So that's one thing we need to hive. We also need to deal with translating from these sector numbers to pages. So we need to hide these erasure blocks in this writing. So the way we're going to do that is with block remapping. We're going to move where a sector is rather than trying to rewrite it. So we're going to tell the OS, yep, I wrote a new version of that. I wrote that. Here's your data for sector 10 is written. But what we're actually going to do is we're going to choose a new location for sector 10 and write it there to avoid having to erase the whole block around it. We also need to hide the limit on the number of erases. Because if you think of something like the file allocation table, that's going to be written more than tens of thousands of times. So to avoid that, we're going to spread the writes out. So as we remap where data is, we're going to make sure it goes all over all the flash in order to have everything erased roughly the same number of times. So let's talk about, give an example of what this might look like. So we have our what's called our flash translation layer, which takes our hard drive interface and turns it into a flash interface. And we're going to have sector numbers the OS knows about, which I'll label this logical here, and locations in the flash that actually correspond to like a particular part of a particular flash chip. So we'll have this table that's going to be maintained by the controller. And we're going to have our actual flash memory, which I said we divide up into these pages. And it contains some data, which is actually being used, which I have in blue. It has some unused data, which I have in gray, which is data where we wrote that data originally, you know, here. But then we needed to make a new copy of it. So we rewrote it elsewhere, and now that data is just sitting there unused. It doesn't contain any useful data information because there's another copy of that sector elsewhere. And we have some erased data that's ready to be written. So when the OS asks to read a sector, it's going to look up in this table, go to that actual part of the flash, and do the read. When the OS asks to write a sector, it's going to choose a new location in this part which is being written, and update its table to point to that location, making a little slice that was previously used unused. Now, the problem here is that if we keep writing things, we're eventually going to go all the way down to here, and we're going to run out of space. So we need some way to reclaim space. And the space we want to reclaim is all this gray stuff. We want to somehow get that back to be usable. So we're going to do what's known as garbage collection. And a way we can do that is we'll take, we want to free up this erasure block here. So we'll take all this data that's still valid, rewrite it somewhere else so we can erase this whole block. And that frees up some space. It frees up space because we weren't rewriting any of the unused gray data, so that's extra space we have available now. Questions on this procedure back there?
Is this the same idea of disk defragmentation and the old hard drive?
So is this the same idea as defragmentation? It's not the same idea, because we don't have, we have less different freedoms than disk defragmentation, but it's a similar mechanism. Your question?
Yeah. How often is this garbage collection happening?
Question is, how often is this happening? Well, it needs to happen fast enough that we can keep writing. And if that doesn't happen, well, the SSD is going to be slow at writing. And in fact, SSDs which are bad at this are slow at writing.
Does it just scan through, and when it finds, you know, enough to do garbage collection, it just does it?
Question, does it just do this on its own? Yes. This is not something that the OS requests explicitly. This is something that the controller does automatically. Yes.
Is metadata kept under block in terms of how many reads and writes it's gone through?
Is data kept in terms of how many reads and writes each block is done?
Yeah.
So probably data on how many writes is done is kept, because when you're doing this garbage collection, you want to make sure that that's relatively even. So that might be kept around. Reads, I don't think, are actually important to reliability. Yes?
So when you're copying like the data from like that pages 256 to 319, where is it stored as like before it gets erased, I believe? Because
where is what stored?
Like the copy data, because it gets moved over to like
So, our question is, where is it stored before it gets erased? So, the typical procedure is we'd first do the copy, so there'd now be two copies, and then we do the erasure.
Okay.
Now, this requires us to have extra space on the flash. An alternative would be, that seems a little dangerous, would be that typically these flash controllers have some RAM, and they could copy it there. But that means that if we lose power, what happens to that data? But so I think the most likely solution is you have a little extra space and you copy.
Oh, okay. Like, but wasn't it mentioned earlier that you can only like write in between erases?
Yes.
So then would that copy be like, when would that copy be done?
So the idea is that we just erased these two blocks earlier, mm-hmm. So we can write to them right now.
Okay.
And that's what we're going to do for the copy.
Okay.
Yes.
The question
is, did I mention for a given erasure block, you only erase about like tens of thousands of times before it's unstable? Yes.
So in my mind, that seems like a very small number based off of the number of times that a block might actually be erased.
The question, isn't that a small number? So I guess there's two things there. So one is that newer technologies might be more in the 50K-ish range, or maybe 100K. The other thing is that if we have a terabyte SSD, if we're thinking about this process, it's when have you written 10,000 terabytes to it that you start running into that problem, because we're spreading the load out evenly. And that actually takes a while for consumer type uses. So this is known as block remapping. So the key idea is on write, we choose a new location because we can't write the old location again without erasing it. And we do garbage collection to erase not just one sector at a time, because we can't do that physically, but whole blocks. This is really complicated. This is why SSDs sometimes have like a real like 100, 200 megahertz processor or something to do this. and also why there's like big differences between SSDs from different manufacturers. Usually it's mostly about what is the software that does this logic look like. So SSDs are a lot faster than hard drives. So reads and writes are sub-milliseconds. And because of how the SSDs work, contiguous blocks don't really matter. They don't matter for writes because, well, they're going to end up being contiguous anyways after the remapping. And they don't matter for reads much because as long as you're reading whole pages of the SSD, like, there's no moving ahead. There's no seeking. But a lot can depend on the performance controller because of this garbage collection, especially if it's almost full. Like, this is where some controllers have problems. So I said SSDs implement the hard drive interface, but there are some differences. So one is that sometimes they have some nice extra commands which are really helpful for SSDs, and one common one is known as trim. And trim is a way for the OS to say, hey, these sectors, I'm not using them anymore. Why would you want to do that? Well, the SSD can do something way more efficient than like zeroing them out. It can just remove them from its block map. And that frees up the space for garbage collection, avoids copying them when it's doing that, freeing up erasure blocks, and it's just a lot better if the OS can give this little extra bit of information. Okay, so any questions on SSDs? Yeah.
Back into a empty slot when it's just going to take up space again.
Why do you want to copy?
So
here
for the garbage collection. So like, wouldn't it just be space again when you copy and then write it to somewhere else?
The question is like, why would I want to copy it here?
Yeah.
Because I want to free up more space, so I have to choose one of these erasure blocks to free up. That's my only option. So regardless of which one I choose, I'm going to have to copy some data.
Would you move the data from one of those erasure blocks to somewhere else? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and that's precisely what this copy here is representing. So I'm taking the data that's in this erasure block, moving it here just so I can free up more space to do more writes. And when I do that, like, yes, I'm doing some work that seems like maybe if I were more clever, I could avoid it. So one final note on things other than SSDs. So there are storage technologies that are on the horizon that are kind of in between SSDs and DRAM. So things which are slower than DRAM, but much faster than SSDs, and have an interface that looks more like memory, but they're persistent. When they lose power, they still keep their data. They have capacities which are larger than DRAM. So there's a question of like, what are file systems for this? I don't know yet. Researchers don't know yet. But something that you might see in the next 5 years or so. Yeah?
Is that like Intel Optane?
Is that like Intel Optane? I believe that is one of the sort of marketed efforts around this sort of thing. Yes?
These non-volatile memories also like die out after getting written to a couple tens of thousands of times.
The question is, do these also have erasure limits? They do not work. There are different technologies, but I don't think they have that kind of physical limitation. Okay, so I'll just introduce our next topic. So next time, we're going to talk about how Unix-like file systems work. And we're going to start with XV6's file system, which does some things better. So it does contiguous reads better. It's better at supporting that. It handles crashes better. It supports something called hard links. It has some different names, but it's also a good example of what a typical Unix file system design is with how it divides of a disk. And I'll just go through, just briefly, the division of the disk. So we have the file system data in our equivalent of a header, which is our super block. So it's the same thing as FAT, stores information about where things are on the disk and where to find things. But we have file information, not stored in directory entries anymore, but stored in these inodes. So we'll talk about what these inodes contain, but rather than having directory entries store like the size of a file and where its data is, that's going to be stored in this inode structure for each file. And rather than storing where the next point, this linked list, we're going to actually store an array of where the data blocks are. And rather than storing like in the fat what was free, we just have an array of what blocks are free. So we'll go into this more next time, talking about more about details about this Unix-like file system design.